danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 209 of the Thinking Poker Podcast from Melrose, Massachusetts. I'm Nate Mavis, and with me from Owings Mills, Maryland.
Oh, good job.
There we go.
That's way harder to remember than Melrose.
There we go. I always get Melrose wrong. Owings Mills, Maryland. Oh, ye of little faith. Andrew Brokus, how are you, Andrew?
I am excellent. How are you?
I'm doing great. Beautiful spring day here. Tomorrow we're going to get another storm, but for now, spring has however temporarily sprung, and okay. I'm happy.
Definitely not a beautiful spring day here. I'm just still jazzed up from playing against Deep Stack last night.
It was super fun. I learned a lot. I occasionally got my butt kicked. It's great.
Yeah, it's really astounding how often I found myself in these spots. And, you know, neither of us is like the greatest heads up, no limit player in the world, but I have a fair bit of experience with it, and I have, you know, spent more time kind of studying the theory of it, looking at GTO solvers and that kind of thing. And the number of times that I found myself in a spot, not always even a big pot, although there were some big pots also where you're facing a bet and you're like, oh, am I supposed to call this or not? But so even just sometimes, you know, pre-flop spots or flop spots, like, do I bet or do I check? There were so many spots where I was really uncertain of the correct answer, and where, not that everything Deep Stack does is guaranteed to be correct, but I think we share the opinion that it played quite well. And there are quite a few things that it did where I was sort of either like, oh, that would not have occurred to me, but I can see why it might be good. And a few things where I was like, whoa, what the hell is going on
here? Yeah. It was really exciting to play against and challenging. Very, very fun. It's really nice to see. It also reminded me just how much of my play is exploitive. Like, so many flop betting and checking decisions, as you just mentioned, I make based on how tough I think a player is going to be later, and precisely how he or she is going to play later. And once I don't have, you know, any exploitive assumptions or many exploitive assumptions to make about that later play, it really puts me in a lot of tough spots on the flop. I don't know if you thought that was a source of some of your flop confusion.
The biggest thing for me, I think, and we kind of discussed this on the air, was I think it's doing a better job, as we would expect, of balancing like check raising ranges than humans would, or raising ranges in general after checking. So, you know, scenarios where, for instance, the flop goes check check and then it checks the turn to you, against a lot of humans just end up being really capped in that kind of scenario, where, like, even if they slow play the flop, if the flop checks through, they'll often take the betting lead on the next street. And so, like, humans tend to be pretty capped there, and it's also often not obvious what good bluffing hands are in that scenario. And just like against humans, you tend not to get check raised that often in that situation. Like, yeah, you know, like almost all humans, or at least, like, I mean, I haven't really played against elite humans, but the non-elite humans I've played against, that I think is one of their biggest leaks, is just like not raising enough, or you're not maintaining an uncapped range that enables them to raise in some scenarios like that one. And so, as much as I was trying to keep in mind that the computer was not a human and was not going to approach the situation in the same way that humans would, that was one of the situations where I most often felt like both of us were getting owned, where you're betting and then getting raised. And it can be correct to bet when you have a hand that doesn't want to face a raise. It's not like you can never bet when you're worried about a check raise. But there's one hand, I think, after you had signed off, where I bet the river. I had bottom pair, and I like checked it for showdown on the flop and turn. But then, like, the river was a card that I, you know, thought I was unlikely to have the best hand anymore on that river card, and I decided to bluff with it, and then it check raised jammed the river with a worse hand.
Yeah.
You know, and essentially, like, bet me off of when I was bluffing with the best hand, it bet me off. And it's just like not the sort of thing you're real likely to run into a human doing.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really sneaky. It's really fun. It'll fold top pair when you don't expect it to fold top pair. It'll fold a flipping six high flush when you expect to be getting value from a lot of other hands. Just really tremendous fun. Also, I was thinking about this as I was walking my dog this morning. That hand where I bet folded the queens, that I think it busted me out the first
you
match.
You bet called
queens. Yeah. Sorry, bet called the queens, and you were suggesting that a bet fold might be better. I think about it. I've got $20 in my pocket for the Boston Debate League that says that bet calling is a lot better than bet folding.
If you've thought about it and arrived at that conclusion, I don't think I want to bet against you.
I think basically my justification is that deep stack will peel the flop so light, and especially with a lot of like one card draws, that it's just going to get to the turn with so many hands that if I bet fold queens, it's really exploitable. So I think it must be raising the turn with a lot of hands I have to call against, you know, especially since I have equity when I'm behind. It's possible that checking and then doing something is better, but I suspect that bet calling as I did is best, and I am more confident that bet calling is significantly better than bet folding. And what's really exciting is that we can actually find out all this because the fine folks at Alberta can tell us what deep stack's ranges are in various spots, so they can go through and actually answer these questions.
Yeah, I'm really eager to see that level of analysis. I think it takes them a little bit of time to get that out, but hopefully that'll be out soon. I'm champing at the bit.
I'm eager, but I'm also worried that it's going to tell me I'm just the biggest fish in the world. It's like,
right.
we got you playing, we've got Terrence playing, and like I just like you saw the 2+2 thread where it listed its results against the first batch of humans that it played, and there were like three people at the bottom that just got smoked by it.
I don't think I did actually.
Well, it's like that, and it's just like a matter of public record that these people could not possibly have been worse against. and I'm worried that'll be me.
Is there a 2+2 thread about us? It didn't occur to me that there might be.
Oh, there probably is, but
I shouldn't do that while we're recording. I'll go get my self-esteem smashed as soon as we end this call.
Wait. This might make good radio. Sean, you can take this out if thinking poker deep stack AI site forumserver.2plus2.com.
I don't see anything in MBG.
Yeah, wait a minute. Thinking poker deep stack site form. Wow, it looks like it's not on 2+2.
Oh, you're so small time.
Yeah, that's really something. So there's one about deep stack.
Is there not an MBG?
Let's see. Brocus deep stack AI site forumserver.2plus2.com. What you got? Concept of the week, improving by mistakes. Nope. Crazy. Absolutely crazy, I tell you. Okay.
The people have no taste.
Yeah, they really don't. They really don't. Boy, 2+2. Very different place 10 years ago, I tell you.
Well, other things that were exciting since the last time we recorded, we also did our event with Just Hands Poker in the New York City area and had an awesome turnout for that. Seemed like everybody really had a good time. I expected it to be fun, but I'm just, anytime there's something that kind of like requires me to leave the house, let alone the area code. And, you know, I had traveled to New York and had some hecticness to the travel. And there's always a part of me that's like, ugh, is this even going to be worth it? Like, wouldn't you have a comparable hourly just playing 5-10 or something?
Yeah.
But it was really a lot more fun than I thought it was going to be. And for those of you who don't know, essentially what we had set up was an RFID poker table with, in most cases, 9 paying customers playing a deep stacked 1-2 game while we were in a recording booth in real time, you know, seeing their hands, commenting on them, putting that out on Twitch as well. And that was really tremendous fun. And I think all the participants had a lot of fun with it as well.
Yeah, it was great. Our listeners are the best. They're just really great. And, you know, meeting more of our listeners was fantastic. I did not meet anyone whose company I didn't really enjoy. And it was the poker was good. I thought people played in a lot of ways, you know, a lot better than I was expecting. You know, there were also plenty of leaks to find. I think if there were a rule against ever calling the small blind against a raise in a 1-2 no limit game, like your average 1-2-0 limit player would be better off. Like if right. whenever there's a raise, like, I mean, it's better to play your aces, but still, like if it were just like a, some sort of nervous tick where whenever you saw a raise, you just folded your small blind. Like right. that would be, that would probably be better than the way, a lot of people are actually playing. Yeah. And, I mean, heaven knows I've had a lot of such leaks in my life, but, many leaks to find, a lot of good play to be observed. I have now added Honda checking to my poker vernacular. So I'm happy about that. I picked up a new piece of lingo and it was just great. The Just Hands guys were a pleasure to work with. Big shout out to Tony, the executive producer. He's the guy who really ran the show. He was fantastic. And, it was just great. Our listeners are fantastic. And one thing that I know that I always try to keep in mind is that there are untold numbers of you who I've never met, who never email, who never comment, who don't go to Las Vegas in the week that we're there, or if they are there, they're too busy playing to come to the meetup, who just have no explicit contact with us. But we really know you're out there, and you guys are just awesome. So yeah, thanks for listening.
I met a guy there who was like, I remember I've been following you since, you know, I never wrote to you anything, but what was the site that you worked for before Tournament Poker Edge, which this is Poker Savvy Plus, which went out of business in 2011. Yeah. And, you know, he'd probably been sort of aware of me since like 2009 or something. And it just like, now, you know, to like listens to the podcast, watches videos, reads the blog, and just like never, you know, said anything to me. But you know, I've been, you know, to some extent a fixture of his poker life for like 8 years, and I'm just now finding out about his existence. It is kind of mind blowing.
Yeah, no, it's great. And they're just every time I go to a casino, or not every time, but many times that I go to a casino or we have a meetup, there are always more people, and our listeners are great. We do not have the biggest listenership in poker media, but I really think we have the best. Not just saying that. Our listeners are fantastic, and it's always a pleasure to meet them. So thanks to everybody for a very successful event.
You want to tell folks about our guest today?
Should absolutely tell folks about our guest today. It's part of the spring of AI, or the winter and spring of AI. And for 1 week, we're having a guest who's more just about the computer end of things and not specifically about AI. He is, by some measures, one of the most famous guests we've ever had on the show. He is Patrick McKenzie, better known as Patio 11 on the internet. He is known as a sort of Hacker News authority. He is a software as a service authority. He has created Bingo Card Creator and Appointment Reminder. Recently, he was involved in Starfighter. He's just one of these people of whom it is true that if you read about software on the internet, in a certain part of the internet, you have read a lot by Patrick. He says that he studied two things in college, how to make things and how to make things up. So he has his background both in writing and in software. Always a pleasure to read. He's got a lot to say, and his views are very, very smart. And he's also a poker player, I found out to my delight recently. And he plays sometimes when he's in Las Vegas on business. So probably he is closer to Angela Bassa than he is to, say, Nikolai Yakovenko, who does other things but has also played in Bobby's Room. He's a casual poker player, but somebody who could monetize his time very easily and yet chooses to play poker with his spare time. And it's a pleasure to meet him.
And these are interviews I find really neat. These kind of like highly successful in another field people who enjoy poker in a kind of amateur way.
Yeah.
I find it really interesting to understand, as you put it, you know, why do you choose to spend some of your valuable time on poker? Why is it interesting to you? How do you think about it? There's so many opportunities for us to hear from, and it's most of what we do, you know, but also in other poker media to hear from like the most highly successful poker players. And many of them are quite diverse in their own ways. But I think, you know, just getting to hear this really a much larger segment of the poker world, the amateur poker
absolutely.
Player. I find it always interesting to talk to those folks.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. I would love to have, say, Matt Damon on the show, who in some sense is like into poker. But like, I would in some ways it would be even more interesting to talk to Sully Erna, right? Like he plays. I think Godsmack, right? Yeah, he is the American vocalist and guitarist for the American hard rock band Godsmack. But I think he plays the main event every year. He just likes
poker. We should be able to make this happen. This is a realistic goal, I think. Getting, I mean, Matt Damon's a reach, but getting Sully Erna on the show should be doable.
Sully Erna is a big star, okay? If Sully Erna's publicist is listening to this, Sully Erna, very big star. Don't mean to, you know, don't mean to despair, you know, to discount the fame of Sully Erna. Yes, if you are listening, Sully Erna, please come on the show. We would love to know why you choose to play poker. But anyway.
Well, I have to say, their lyrics don't make it, would not seem to indicate that they're the friendliest folks. I think two of their biggest hits are like, stay away and go away or something like that.
Yeah, sure. Whatever. Like, come on. Like, I can't take a little abuse. Come on. Like, get on, abuse me, then tell me why you like poker. It's fine. but yes, Patrick McKenzie, the Sully Erna of software. So that's...
I've never met Sully Erna, but I'm going to go out on a limb and say they probably have pretty different personalities.
I mean, certainly Sully Erna's got a lot more tattoos than Patrick McKenzie. More facial hair, too. Probably a little bit less fluent with Ruby on Rails.
The Spring Championship of Online Poker is just about a month away, and the World Series of Poker will start just a few weeks after that. Whether you're playing either of those series, or just in general looking to give your poker game a spring cleaning, now is the time for a tune-up. Sign up today at tournamentpokeredge.com in order to get access to hundreds of videos from myself, from Nate Mavis, from many of our former guests, and from plenty of other very talented poker players for as little as $25 a month, tournamentpokeredge.com.
So we are here today with Patrick. If you are listening to this, you have probably never heard of Patrick McKenzie before, or you think he's really, really internet famous. There's probably not a lot that's in between. I would describe him as an entrepreneur, as a software guy, as a very famous internet writer and blogger on various tech topics, a sort of public intellectual in the new style in the world of software and consulting and things like that. He lives in Japan. He has a family. He writes about all these things, and we're very grateful to have him on the show today. Would you say that's accurate, Patrick?
I say most of that is accurate. Thanks very much for having me, guys. Always a pleasure to talk to smart folks about fun, interesting things. It's funny, like, I probably wouldn't have described myself as a public intellectual, but you did mention that in the email to me, and that was kind of like my dream job growing up. Yeah. Like, I wanted to get a PhD and then get paid just to think about things. And then as I got further and further into academia, I found that PhDs actually don't really get paid for thinking about things. They mostly get paid for writing grant proposals, which is just a terrible, terrible life. So bailed out of that, and then bailed so far that I ended up in Japan and did a bunch of things, founded a software company that kind of took over my life. So I guess while running the software company, I basically got paid to occasionally make tweaks to software, but spend most of my time posting on Hacker News. And these days I get paid for basically telling other people how to run their software companies more effectively and posting on Hacker News. Kind of works.
Yeah, that sounds very good. I have a sort of meta-level question here, and it already intersects with poker. You're big into efficiency. You're big about optimizing various aspects of your professional life. And I'm a little bit curious about your continued investment in Hacker News. There came a point when I realized that when an article got posted on Hacker News that I on a subject I knew a lot about, the comments were like really off base and really naive and not useful, not accurate, often not very well thought out. And then I thought that this amounted to a sort of training testing situation. like Hacker News is performing very poorly on my training set. Why should I trust it out of sample? Do you think this is a good critique of Hacker News?
My enthusiasm for Hacker News as a community waxes and wanes depending on, I think it goes through phases. It went through a sharp decline in comment quality in the like 3 to 4 year ago range. and then got a lot better as Dan Gruesome, Deng, and the rest of the moderation team really kind of like abandoned the previous Lazy Fair thing and started to aggressively prune trolls. And at the moment, I think it's probably better with regards to respect of other people, but the concentration of folks who are really, really at the top of their game on the topic of any given thread is not as high as it used to be. And so previously when, you know, you'd have a thread about something consulting oriented and entrepreneurial, it would reliably have 30% of the comments be made by people who had run consultancies before in a very effective manner, like Thomas Tachek, other folks. These days, those sort of comments still exist, but you have to wade through a whole lot more of, well, on a consulting topic, like the guy who's you know, got insufficient pipeline for his $20 an hour WordPress themes installing business, which I love all businesses everywhere, but they often don't have the correct perspective to give people good advice on how to move their consulting businesses forward. So why do I still do it? One is that I'm stubborn and a creature of habit. Another is that I feel an enormous debt to that community. A lot of what I have professionally at the moment is as a result of meeting people on there. Actually, a good set of my core group of friends I met on Hacker News originally. Part of me feels like the, you know, for the kind of folks who are getting their career slash business established in 2017, the internet needs to have some watering holes for them too. And if Hacker News is the, you know, it's imperfect, but what we have for a watering hole right now, then I kind of feel obliged to be at that watering hole. Mm-hmm. Although part of my current job is establishing more watering holes on the internet for upcoming entrepreneurs. So there's that too.
Yeah. And I think it's a more general question, and one that already intersects with poker, is like, how do you learn from the internet most effectively? Back in the day, I learned a lot of what I know about poker from the 2+2 forums. It seems to me that forums are a worse and worse way to learn about poker, except maybe in either niche forums or forums tied to training sites or something else. But and it's sort of a common question, but there's so much information out there. You know, you're generally a fan of the internet. How do you go about learning from the internet, and what can the average person do to learn more effectively?
That's interesting. I've been thinking about it recently. When I was kind of coming up in my business, blogs were basically where it was at to learn the tactics and strategy of building businesses. Joel Spolsky's blog was particularly impactful on me, Paul Graham's essays as well. The SEO Moz blog, the SEO book blog, a few others. And I don't know if it's that was at, you know, I was at a particular point in my skill curve in life where I could get signal from blogs at that point, and then that signal still exists, but I don't need it anymore, or if it's just the blogging community moved on and the people who are currently blogging are just like not that useful at it, or what. But I would have difficulty pointing to much text-based media at the moment that I really like and enjoy on virtually any subject, which is unfortunate because I like reading a lot. I probably do 100 books a year on my Kindle. Well, slightly less now that I have two kids, but used to. But in terms of learning things that helped me push the skill envelope outwards, I don't do all that much reading that it feels really impactful anymore, which is sad. For a while, I was very big into podcasts. On a podcast right now, that seems appropriate. I use podcasts a lot in my time between things. So like if I go to the gym, going to the gym is not really a destination activity for me. I do it because I don't want to die. But I always feel like every minute at the gym is wasted, even though I guess theoretically speaking, increasing the lifespan is not wasteful.
But, yeah, you get a rebate on those minutes. It's great.
I just hate it. I put a podcast on and then feel like my brain is not totally turned off for an hour. And so that's nice. But again, there's still a couple podcasts that I listen to on entrepreneurial topics where I feel like I occasionally get flashes of inspiration from them, but I don't often feel flashes of insight. I kind of consume a wider range of podcasts than I did of blogs, partly because topics that I know less about seem to have a higher delta on the learning value than I do on other things. So, for example, I know very little about poker. So listening to a podcast about poker from people who are good at poker has a kind of higher ROI in things I learned that I didn't know before per hour than listening to two folks talking about SaaS. That's software as a service for those of you who aren't in the SaaS industry. And then I find myself watching YouTube videos, although YouTube videos are, there's a narrow range of content that videos seem to be like the best instructional thing for them. For me, it's kind of entertainment related or entertainment adjacent. So video games and poker for folks who are streaming and then YouTubing their poker performances. I seem to get a lot of value from video and occasionally videos of really good conference talks, but otherwise I generally feel like I need 100% of my attention to watch a video and 100% of my attention on something delivered at a normal human rate of speaking is very rarely a good use of my time.
Mm-hmm. So you've given us an opportunity to segue to poker, but we have to ask anybody who mentions being a reader on the show, what's the best book you've read this year?
Ooh.
Or in the last 12 months.
If that's, I was going to say the year is answer. Young.
That is a good question. And I should have a better answer for it, but I'm kind of, everything I've read in the past year has been cash evicted by the number of things I've read in the past 100 hours. I've been going through a bunch of YC applications for 50 plus startups. And basically, growth in MRR, that's monthly recurring revenue, it's a business jargon for those of you who aren't in that field, is basically like ruling all of my thoughts at the moment. And what was the last good book I read? I don't have the title in front of me. I read three separate books on money laundering this last year, which was fascinating to me because I didn't know all that much about money laundering, and now I know fractionally more about money laundering.
It's in the news today, by the way. We're recording on March 22nd, and some of the what's-his-face, the Manafort news just dropped today, so it's timely. Go ahead.
So I work at a payment processor, and I went in a chat one day and said, I've read three really great books in the last week, and they're all about money laundering. And if, you know, people whose job titles like compliance, blah, 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 blah. And you generally shouldn't open a conversation with compliance people. And like, I'm reading about money laundering this week, unless you want to get asked some pointed questions.
Sure.
That's mostly a joke. But
what's the best
book? It's like going to.
Oh, go ahead.
It's kind of like going into, you know, your job in a prosecutor's office and saying like, yeah, I've been reading books about how to hide dead bodies. Yeah. You know about the multiple uses of lime? They're fascinating.
I remember being at a doctor's office once and he said that like, I need such and such records from you. And I said like, really? That's all you need? Those would be so easy to falsify. And then he looked at me and just said, like, don't say that to me. Like, you're not supposed to do that. It's what's the best book I can read about money laundering? Do you remember any of the titles?
I'd have to pull the name off my Kindle. How about I do that later and you can put the links in the description or something.
Yeah, that'd be fantastic. By the way, my answer to my own question is the Complacent Class by Tyler Cowen. So, yeah.
He has a new book out.
He does have a new book out. It's fantastic. It's really, really good. It might be his best book, and that's saying a lot.
I'm going to read the heck about that on my next plane flight. Thank you.
Yeah. So you play poker, and we started the show, as people have heard many times, to discuss, among other things, the connections between poker and other parts of life. You are somebody who has done a lot of things and who is really well aware of the scarcity of your time. And has written a lot about how valuable time is. Yet you spend some of that scarce time on poker, even when, you know, as a consultant, as somebody with other things going on, you could easily monetize your free time instead of just doing leisure things with it. Why poker? Why is poker good enough to spend scarce time on?
It's funny. So I only got into poker in the last 3-4 years of my life or so. Actually, it's a funny story with that. Why still play it? So it's an intellectual challenge, and I like intellectual challenges. It has elements of being a video game, but much more cerebral than most video games are for me. I dabble in poker. I more than dabble in video games over the years and have been attempting to decrease the amount of time that I more than dabble in video games. The monetary aspect about it kind of, it hacks my psyche in a way that is like locally not optimal, but probably globally optimal for me, in that putting very small amounts of money on the line causes me to think about something in an entirely different fashion than I do if there is no money on the line. But there are such small amounts of money on the line that they can't possibly matter to my family's personal finances. So basically lets me exercise all of my like stupid risk-seeking, thrill-seeking demons for trivial amounts of money, whereas exercising them in like business decisions would be, well, let's say if I have a leak in my business game that causes me to make negative EV decisions when there's like tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars on the line, just because I want to like let it ride, that would be bad. But if I can do that at $11 multi-table tourneys on PokerStars, then I can lose as many of those as I want, and it will never matter to my balance sheet at the end of the week. So, I guess that's most of it.
Right. So it's a sort of training ground for you. It's intellectual exercise, and it's a path to self-knowledge. This is what I think David Mamet thought was so good about poker, or one of the things he thought was so good about poker. Yeah.
Also kind of like a ritualized combat might not be the right word. It's funny. In business, in gaming land, we sometimes talk about PvP versus PvE, player versus player, and player versus the environment. Mm-hmm. PvP is like, I win, you, ergo you lose competition, and player versus the environment is generally, we can all win together sort of competition. Mm-hmm. And I generally think that business is PvE more than it is PvP, which many capitalists would not agree with me on that. But I think that creating value is positive sum. But that being said, there's something in my lizard brain that really likes, like, I will beat you and crush you and hear the lamentations of your women. And so having a game where I can, like, get that out of my system to go back to doing the, you know, positive for the world stuff is good. I used to do debate for the same reason, and I think one or both of you were former debaters as well. So that was
that
interesting
would be me,
too.
Yeah.
Yep.
No, please go on. I didn't mean to cut you off there.
I originally got into debate to work on my speech impediment of all things, but I kept doing it because the opportunity to kind of like through surplus cycles at an intellectually rewarding form of competition was really, really addicting to me. And I did that for a very long time. And even after I was out of doing it, I ran a online forum for debaters for probably close to a decade. And then the business thing came along, and then through more cycles at business. And then when I found that not 100% of my cycles were getting profitably used in business, I took up, I guess, poker for the entertainment things. Sorry, that's a little bit rambling.
No, I mean, you certainly piqued my interest with the debate mention. I'm curious, just because you mentioned poker specifically being a way to kind of get out some of your more competitive impulses. Do you engage in kind of like the chat box? I mean, are you actively mocking your opponents as you're defeating them?
Oh, goodness, no. I try to be a very friendly, outgoing person in most things. Outgoing is a stretch for me because I'm kind of an introvert, but I try to present as being an extrovert. If I'm talking in the chat box, it's usually telling someone good hand or telling them what my cards were, because I'm generally at the table to have fun rather than to win lots of money. Like, I really like chatting about hands that just happened with folks, which I know is something that many folks, that is not the reason they are at the poker table. But like, I will happily give more information than I strictly speaking need to, or say, yeah, that fold was good, I had the nuts, or and then show them if it's a live game or if it's on a platform that supports that, or that sort of thing. Or once there was someone, at a tournament who was basically asking me my life story to get a read on me, and I'm like, I'm happy to tell you my life story because I'm a very bad poker player who is here recreationally, and if you think you are probably better than me, you are right. And all of the signal that you were trying to get from me right now. I'm smart enough to tell that you were trying to get signal, but not good enough to not give it to you.
when you're playing like online, or I guess live also, I mean, is that a single tasking thing for you, or are you playing multiple tables? Are you listening to podcasts or watching YouTube videos at the same time?
If I'm doing multiple tables, something has gone wrong in my tournament selection, which happens occasionally. I am intellectually capable of playing two tables at once, but it wrecks me in terms of the amount of stress. Even at, again, there should be no reason why there's stress involved here, but the multitasking just totally destroys me. That said, because there's lots of downtime in multi-table tournaments, if you're playing at, like, say, Turbo Speed on PokerStars, I typically have one other thing going on. Maybe I'm reading a blog post or something, and I alt-tab back into the game every time I actually have a decision to make. If I'm doing live poker, for whatever reason, takes 100% of my cycles. Looking around the table, watching people, thinking about how things are going, thinking about what my next couple of plans are. I spend a ridiculous amount of time actually physically manipulating chips because I don't play live poker enough to have good physical control of chips, and I don't have good fine motor control at the best of times. So, there's definitely been mistakes I've made in life because I was too busy stacking chips to do math. typically single tasking that.
And do you have thoughts on single tasking more generally? I mean, it sounds like you're pretty big on the idea of kind of, you know, efficiency and trying to use your cycles efficiently, as it were. But I imagine, you know, as both a debater and just an intelligent person, you've kind of considered the alternate perspective of, you know, maybe I should be trying to be more mindful or be, you know, 100% focused on the one thing that I'm doing right now. And I don't know, how do you weigh those things?
I don't know. I think the research shows that there is a marked drop-off in task success when you multitask. And I think the research also shows that people, they rate their ability to multitask much higher than it objectively is. And the few times I've tried to do, like, you know, sample size one experiments on this, I've found pretty convincingly that while I don't feel like I lose 30 IQ points when I'm doing two things at once, it certainly looks like I do. Given that, I would pay a whole heck of a lot of money to have 30 extra IQ points at all time. I should probably avoid multitasking when I can possibly avoid it if I'm doing anything that's anywhere close to rate limited on IQ.
I guess I was thinking of, like, you know, listening to a podcast when you go to the gym or something, but I guess you're thinking, yeah, like the physical part of being at the gym isn't consuming much mental energy.
Yeah, the you know, if it's like walking to work or being at a gym or something, I can basically run that with a background process, so I can spend most of my time thinking about you know, what the podcast host is saying. Although, if I ever get involved in a car accident, that's probably why. Obviously, I would not do this while driving a car, but I walk places, so if a car intersects with me because I'm, you know, thinking about MRR growth and not thinking about maybe that guy barreling down the street should have the intersection and I should not. Yeah.
Are there things that you kind of either discovered about poker or discovered through poker as you've studied it and played it? I mean, ways that the way that you either think about the game changed over time, or the way that you think about other things changed as a result of thinking about poker?
So I'm a bit of an introvert, and if you can think of, like, the learning curve for skills, I'm a bit behind on my learning curve for social skills for basically my entire life. And it helps me to explicitly be reminded that if I'm in a conversation with someone or some sort of relationship, business relationship, negotiation, whatever, that there is another counterparty, and the other counterparty has a theory of a mind of me, which is influenced by my actions. And so I have to, like, play the game at a couple of levels where not only am I saying something which is true, but also something which is true, which will be observed by you, which is going to be input to your next decision. And poker is actually really good training for that. At least it's training to, you know, remember you're not just playing your hand, you're also playing his perception of your hand, which is a really useful thing for me to keep in mind, because that does not come naturally to me. I'm almost always playing my hand in most things and completely oblivious to how other people see my hand, which not always plus EV. So getting better at like the step. Okay, step back from this salary negotiation for a moment. What does it say to your counterparty in the salary negotiation when you say this true thing that you just blurted out? Maybe that thing wasn't the right thing to blurt out, or maybe you know you should pick another true thing that would continue telling the story that the first true thing did in a way that is in your long-term interests.
It's interesting. So the salary negotiation example is in some sense adversarial, but not really. I think you would say, there are some examples that are obviously non-adversarial, where poker's sort of competitive aspect has non-competitive consequences. So it seems to me that what you just said entails that poker makes you a better communicator, because it causes you to always keep in mind that what you're saying not only communicates something, but may have any number of other effects on your audience, including causing them to update their mental model of you. And that's really valuable even when your goals are not adversarial. It might be especially valuable when there are all sorts of reasons to send appropriate signals, to consider all sorts of other consequences of communication, say in a workplace with one's spouse, etc. Would you agree with that?
Yep, that's pretty much exactly where I'm coming from. It, although, I do think that salary negotiations are often more adversarial, even in a non-adversarial relationship, than they are. They're probably the closest thing to, it's not quite zero sum, but closest thing to like directly competitive interests that I routinely write about, simply because they're, like the money at play there, it either goes in one pocket or it goes in the other pocket, but it does not suddenly become 40% more money because you did the breakdown of it well.
Sure. Well, there's like a principal agent issue. I was reading this really smart article about salary negotiation, and it mentioned that like if you want to do your new boss a favor, what you should do is, among other things, get the highest possible salary, because this has all sorts of good effects for him. In that respect, there can be a positive sum aspect to a salary negotiation, right?
That's true.
And for readers who have not read all of Patrick's stuff twice, Patrick is in fact the guy who wrote that article.
Yeah, I did say that.
That's great, because I was aware of that just from the way Nate said it. It's awesome that Patrick was not.
So no lie, one reason that I write so much is that I used to have, and when I was rather young, I had an eidetic memory. And then I lost the eidetic memory except for things that I had written. And so writing a lot means you remember a lot, so you should write more, right? And apparently at 1 a.m. in the morning, I no longer have an eidetic memory for all 3 million words that I've written professionally in the last 10 years. But congrats. I might have caught that if it had been not 1 a.m. in the morning.
On a slightly different tack,
before we take a slightly different tack, can I jump in?
Please.
I'm reminded, Patrick, of what you said about, you kind of quickly retracted this or wanted to rephrase it, but, calling poker ritualized combat. And I think I can identify with the idea of kind of like being an introvert who wants to present as an extrovert or at least have that skill available to you. And personally, I found poker useful in the sense of it creates a space where deception and competitiveness are expected by everyone, at which point it's arguable if it's even deceptive. Like if everyone knows that you're, it's kind of like completely within the rules that you're attempting to be deceptive, then, it doesn't feel like an unethical form of deception. And I've found it's been good training for me just in that sense of like, this is a space where it's, where everything is actively being used against you, and it's entirely acceptable to do things that would otherwise be considered socially unacceptable, like if someone asks you a question, to just ignore them and not respond to it. And so I found it to be, you know, useful to me to develop the skills to be a little bit tougher in other kinds of situations where people do, you know, sort of try to pressure you socially. Is that the kind of thing you had in mind when you mentioned, like, ritualized combat?
Yep. I like that idea of creating a safe space for doing things which are useful things to have in your toolbox, but which are difficult if you don't have the natural radar for how to employ them in socially appropriate fashions. Like aggression, for example. Aggression is something that, if you have too much of it, you get heavily stigmatized by society. But society also doesn't expect you to have zero. In fact, zero is often a catastrophically wrong amount to have. So being able to titrate yourself to the right amount in given social circumstances is useful. And poker is nice because it's a there's definitely, like, wrong amounts of aggression to have in a poker game, but there's almost never a wrong amount, like, such a wrong amount of aggression to apply in poker that it would impact your social standing after the game is over. I guess if you're a professional poker player, maybe there are socially rude things that you could say at a table that would impact your standing. But, like, you can't be aggressive in a way to abuse someone in hand in such a way that makes other people think less of you after the game's over.
Mm-hmm. Is ritualized aggression and creating training grounds for the cultivation of virtue, in some sense, is that something that the Japanese do better than Americans?
I do not know many people who would agree with that.
Okay.
I think that, if anything, many observers of Japanese culture would say that that aggression gets subliminated a bit into social structures here.
Okay.
But that's probably a long discussion for someone who's smarter than me.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, I'm just happy because, you know, Japan is really into baseball, probably more than America these days, and I think that's all the better for Japan and a shame for America. But yeah, so the thing I was going to ask earlier is, we have a lot of listeners to the show and even occasional guests on the show who are these really talented people who have done well at poker. They're quantitatively sharp. They're adaptable. They're capable of doing all the little miscellaneous things that allow them to be successful poker pros. And they're thinking maybe they want to get out of poker, and they're thinking that maybe something in software or software adjacent might be for them, but they just don't know how to start. I think that in a lot of these cases, these people underrate how valuable it is that they've done all those extra little things, like figured out how to file their taxes and how to game select and how to manage their careers and done just all these little things that a company might take care of for you, but actually shows quite a broad practical intelligence. But more generally, my question is, what advice do you have for somebody like that who is looking maybe to get into software, maybe doesn't have a fancy CV, has some quantitative ability and a lot of practical intelligence, but doesn't know where to start?
Sure. I would pick up one programming language, preferably a scripting language, under your belt as soon as possible. Ruby or Python are great choices. Knowing a scripting language is kind of like knowing Excel really well, except I think more useful than Excel in a lot of ways. Basically, every white collar job that you can imagine in any walk of life, you get much better at it after you are able to do Excel well, and you get orders of magnitude better after you're able to do programming in a scripting language, even if you're not the sharpest knife in the drawer at programming. I think that poker players would literally be better at running the business of being an independent entertainment provider, which is like what poker pros are, right? Like, you would literally be a better poker pro, not at the table, but at all the other stuff you have to do, if you are able to do Ruby as well. You'll spend less time worrying about your taxes every year. There's probably ways to program in such a fashion that you can manage your schedule better and or do better analysis on your hand histories if you play in such a manner that you have hand histories available. Would strongly suggest doing that first. In terms of breaking into the industry without a great CV, the industry seems to wax and wane on how easy that is to do. The good news front right now, there is a crushing demand for programmers of basically every stripe, which kind of makes it easier to paper over the fact that you don't have, say, a professional CS degree. I would strongly, if you have a little bit of money, I would strongly suggest doing at least like a coding boot camp so that you can see what actual professional web development looks like at a in modern stacks. I have a standing offer to any of my brothers or sisters or cousins that if they get a, most of them have a degree in something in liberal arts, which I'm not bullish on the value of most of those degrees. And if any of them have like a math or analytical aptitude and want to do a programming boot camp, I will pay for that boot camp basically sight unseen. I think there's probably better boot camps and worse boot camps, but the general value prop of them seems very, very strong to me. So you do that for the 6 weeks, get to the point where you can ship like baby's first Rails application, actually do ship baby's first Rails application. And now, good news, you're basically heading to the flop with like pocket nines, meaning you're ahead of the vast majority of the hiring pool. If you've ever done hiring for a programming job before,
and I have.
Will come in with any two. Oh man. An anecdote for you. At a Japanese software company attempting to hire a bilingual English-Japanese software engineer, we got one guy whose definition of being bilingual in Japanese was that he had watched two episodes of Kenshin once, and literally got to an on-site interview in Japan with that, because the tech industry is fundamentally unserious about how it does hiring, and nobody thought to ask him to say a single sentence of Japanese prior to being at the interview. That's pretty much the bar. Don't be that incompetent. It's also a good place to use your poker trained aggression, like be a little more aggressive than you think you can be, because the vast majority of the field in tech is far less than they should be. Being kind of a little bit aggressive with regards to like what companies you apply to. Don't self-select yourself out of the pool. Let them tell you no. Kind of overreach a little bit, especially in the early years of your career. Those are generally my pieces of advice for getting started in the field.
Mm-hmm. So one theme in your writings is I think of as eliminating friction. And so one thing I have in mind is, you always say charge more for what you're doing. Be willing to change your rates. Be willing to understand just how much value you can provide to somebody else. Conversely, you often advocate for outsourcing things that you aren't good at, for buying software that's good, even if the sticker price is non-negligible. In fact, you would argue that sticker prices that seem non-negligible often are negligible. And in general, just try to be more efficient and look for ways to break out of routines in order to do that. And I think a lot of us believe things like this, but find that it takes a sort of mental effort or habits that can be hard to deploy at every minute of the day. Is this something that comes naturally to you, or are there tricks that you use to keep your antennae up for ways to optimize and outsource and do all these things?
I wouldn't say that this comes naturally to me. It's sort of a skill. It's, like many skills, gets better with practice. I've been running past tense now, I ran a business for about 10 years. And after doing something for 10 years, knock on wood, hopefully you're a little better than when you were first doing it. if not, stop doing that thing, do something else, preferably a couple of years before the 10th year. the bring it back to poker for a second. Another thing poker does is help reconfigure your relationship with money, which I think a lot of people gets set on the basis of one's upbringing in a way that is not locally or globally optimal. So at my own particular relationship with money growing up, where penny saved is a penny earned, and trivial amounts of money for an employed professional would weigh very heavily on my mind. And that is a habit that you want to get out of really, really quickly, as soon as you're, you know, past starvation levels, because spending money to make money or spending money to increase your career capital, et cetera, has stupidly effective ROI relative to attempting to, you know, go from like a personal burn rate of $1,100 a month down to a personal burn rate of $1,045 a month. It's particularly for early stage careers for folks who are in the technology industry or in a similar white collar profession where there's lots of elasticity in how much you could possibly be earning based on how effective your business is or your business skills are or your career growth is, et cetera, et cetera. You have just so much more leverage on focusing on the other side of the ledger. How do I work in such a fashion that I achieve a bump in my business success or my career success? And then if so, then the expense side doesn't really matter nearly as much. And that took me a long time to both realize and even longer to be routinely deploying as not an accident, but that's why you practice. And now that's why I tell everybody to it, because hopefully I can shave a couple of years off the realization process for them.
So this is the part of you that, or well, this is the aspect of you that says, you know, it's just an $11 tournament. If I can glean some life lessons out of it, it'll pay for itself many, many times over. And the actual sticker cost of the tournament is negligible in the overall flow of money in my life.
I think, my poker expenses basically go straight into the entertainment bucket. So I don't really think of there being much of an ROI, if at all, on $11 tournaments. But there is certainly a sense in which doing taxes, for example, I paid, I did all my own taxes for 8 years, and this last year I just paid just on the Japanese side of things, about $3,000 for someone to do my taxes for me. And if you had told me when I was 24, you will eventually pay someone $3,000 to do your taxes, I would have told you when I was 24. I will never pay someone a month's salary to do my taxes. That's insane. But they certainly do a better job in my taxes than I would have. There's massive optionality to me knowing that I, you know, in the event of an audit, I will not lose 2 weeks of my life justifying things, not because I was doing anything shady on my taxes, but simply because, you know, audits affect people at a random percentage. And then me actually having to walk someone through my taxes would take a gratuitous amount of time. They probably do a better job at me at the, you know, identifying the gray areas in tax law where I do not know the appropriate level of aggression, but they do. And so they, you know, make the appropriate level of aggressive decisions such that that I'm not doing the tax equivalent of like folding pocket jacks simply because someone has raised in front of me. Et cetera, et cetera. Poker is a great source for metaphors. I wish I could use more of these with my software people more often. And you know, the reason why it makes sense to spend $3,000 on tax preparation is that there's after you realize that the income side of the ledger is imprecise on this. I can't remember the precise word, whatever. That income is not a static number. If you can expend brain sweat to increase income, then there's lots and lots of ways to pull $3,000 out of the universe versus essentially paying yourself $3,000 to do your own taxes.
And after all, that $3,000 is probably tax deductible. Yes?
It is certainly tax deductible if your business pays for it as a business expense.
So,
are there any poker professionals here who do not have, like, aren't running your business like a business, you should really get a book on running a small business and start running a small business. I know there's like some there are some subtleties around how you have to do things if you're gambling, and the IRS has publication about it. But on all the like non-gambling parts of the business, spending a couple hours to like recognize how much in your life is deductible as the expenses of an independent entertainment contractor is like a really good use of your time.
Yeah, no, I would also recommend that. Like, just learning about what your obligations are and conversely what your rights and options are as a citizen. Like, a lot of people sort of don't like taxes and sort of like feeling like they're outside of the game if they're poker pros, but you are not, in fact, outside of the game. You are very much earning income that is taxable. Mm-hmm. One thing that poker players worry about, you know, the not really fictional, but the generalized poker player who is thinking about getting out of poker and into a job is, you know, they like being their own bosses. They like being able to turn time into money and, you know, whenever they like, or not doing it whenever they like. And the thought of having a job seems like a burden to them. You are somebody who was your own boss for a long time, and now you work for a company. Is it horribly burdensome?
I think that depends a lot on the situation in which you find yourself in. I will tell you that a lot of folks who do not run their own business have a distorted perception of how much of being your own boss you are when you're running your own business. Poker, especially for online poker, you have the magic ability to turn on the box when you want and then turn off the box when you want, I guess subject to the timeline for tournaments. Like, you know, walking up from the table when you're in the middle of an MTT that you're actually doing well at is probably not a great decision. Like a lot of things in running a business, there's a bit of a lead time to them. You have the ability to turn time into money at the margin, but you don't necessarily have full schedulability of certain things in the business. For example, if I was doing a consulting engagement, I would typically be sold on a per week basis, and you can pick which week, but after you've picked that week, you have to show up for all of the week in general. Where was I going with that? So working at a company, I have substantial but not total latitude in how I arrange my days as a result of both what my job is at the company, how this particular company's culture operates, and what stage our projects are at. And honestly, like, losing autonomy was my number one worry when I was joining the company. I happy to report that hasn't happened. But at the same time, like, you know, there's a weekly meeting, and the weekly meeting happens when the weekly meeting happens, and I have to be at the weekly meeting or you know, suffer the pains of not having been at the weekly meeting. And that's a new experience for me, which has relatively little impact on my life, but a perhaps outsized impact in how I think about things. There's a psychic cost there. You know, like, darn it, I had total optionality for arranging every hour of my life before, and now there's an entire hour of every week that is spoken for. Dang it. That's like infinite increase in the amount of scheduled time that I had.
So one reason you came on the show is you said you viewed it as a partial investment in preparation before your trip to Las Vegas for business, but on which you will play some poker. Is there anything you want to ask us? For the sake of preparation.
That's a good question. So typically when I go to Las Vegas, I play for background for folks who don't know me, I'm a very bad poker player. I'm getting good enough to routinely beat very low stakes tournaments on PokerStars. I don't play cash games very often on PokerStars. My poison of choice in Las Vegas is 1-2 at the MGM, cash games, and then tournaments. I've done well enough at enough live tournaments to know that I'm probably way ahead of the average, like the average person at a $50 tournament on a Saturday. I don't have a great read of how I am relative to like a 1-2 table, although I assume that I'm probably better than most people at the 1-2 table these days. But I remember getting my face absolutely ground in last year a bunch of times. So the question is, do I do 1-2 again this year, or do I move up to 2-5? Not again because the mathematical difference between 1-2 and 2-5 matters to me, but because, you know, will I learn more getting my face ground in by an entirely new class of poker player? I guess that's my main question.
All right. So a few thoughts. One is that if you are really much better than the field at your average daily tournament in Las Vegas, you are probably also better than the field at your average 1-2 table in Las Vegas. Those player pools are highly overlapping. And I'm not sure one's much better or worse than the other. So on one side of that equation, you're probably mistaking luck for skill. It could be that you're mistaking bad luck for bad skill in cash games, or good luck for good skill in tournaments. Or it could be that your game is just much more optimized to tournaments than it is to cash games. In general, I would say that if you cannot beat low stakes, no limit, if you move up to slightly higher low stakes, no limit, you're going to get smashed even more, and it probably won't be much better of a learning experience for you. Like, you would learn just as much trying to improve yourself at 1-2 no limit. I have students have had students who are playing 1-2, and I generally think that studying carefully and observing carefully and just playing more at 1-2 is the way to go, and there are many lessons to learn there. That said, as I said before, especially if you have some sense of the game, have success in other aspects of poker, it could be that it's just variance causing you to lose at 1-2 so far, and that you could move up to 2-5 and not figure two get your face bashed in. In that case, you will face some better players. You'll face a lot of different kinds of moves and plays and things like that. Like, they won't be really good, but it's a different kind of game on average. That said, I probably wouldn't recommend it, especially if you aren't trying to make money at the game. What do you think, Andrew?
Yeah, I'm not that this is exactly what you're asking, but there is a kind of general question that I or we get a lot of, the form of, you know, how can I learn at 1-2? You know, everyone here is bad. I have to play against good players to learn. And first off, I tend to think that like the most important poker skill at any level you're playing at is just, I mean, learning how to beat bad players. Like, you never really want to be in a game without bad players, or you're kind of doing it wrong already if you're sitting in a game consisting entirely of good players, and most of the money is going to come from the weaker players. So learning how to recognize what exactly are the things that these players are doing wrong, and how can I take advantage of those things to the maximum. You know, this is something like poker is not, it's not just, well, I either won or I lost. It matters how much you win by. So just saying I'm playing better than these people, there's still plenty of room for optimization in terms of learning how to, you know, maximize your ability to play better than those people. That said, you know, people will make different sorts of mistakes playing at higher stakes, and it can be somewhat more complicated to figure out how to take advantage of the things that they're doing wrong. But I probably wouldn't recommend, unless you're already saying to yourself, look, I've figured out how to beat these 1-2 games. Everyone just calls too much, and so I just kind of wait around until I have strong hands, and I fold when they make big bets because they always have it. If you feel like it's just kind of become robotic for you to beat a 1-2 game, or you already have a very clear sense of, like, here are all the mistakes people are making, that I would say would be the best case for moving up. In terms of learning just from, not that this is something you explicitly suggested, but the idea of, well, if I play with better players, I can learn from them by imitating them, I would say that the vast majority of people you're going to encounter at 2-5 games in Las Vegas are not good enough that you want to be learning from them. They are probably like less bad than, or they are certainly less bad than like the average 1-2 player you'll encounter, but I think you're more likely to pick up bad habits than you are to kind of recognize useful things that those people are doing that you could yourself do.
It's like I will open up GitHub to a random repository, and I will copy that code and study it to become a better programmer. It's not the most efficient thing to do, and you're drawing from a pool that is full of pretty serious people, but, you know, I think you got it.
Yep, gotcha.
Well, it's very late at night / early in the morning where you are. You've been very generous with your time. I've really enjoyed this. I've learned a lot. I think our listeners have too. I really, really appreciate you coming on the show. Any final words from you?
Well, if I can ever help anybody out with anything, my email address is Patrick, P-A-T-R-I-C-K, at Kalzumeus, K-A-L-Z-U-M-E-U-S.com. I love getting email from the internet. Generally, it's from software people, but if you're a poker person who wants to transition into software, I guess you're software people already, so feel free to email me anytime. And yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. Thank you. It's been great. Thanks so much.
Nice to meet you, Patrick. Take care.
Nice to meet you as well. Take care.